You may be forgiven if you've never heard of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. 1953 movie musical was the brainchild of Dr. Seuss, but it bombed. And now, it shows up on cable TV and in special screenings, and it's earned a devoted following. 57 years after its premiere, the soundtrack has finally been released. Our man Jeff London has the story.
As cult classics go, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is definitely one of the kookiest.
I want my undulating undies with the marabou frills. I want my beautiful bolero with the porcupine quills. I want my purple nylon girdle with the orange blossom buds. Cause I'm going do-me-doing in my do-me-do duds.
Singer Michael Feinstein is a fan.
This film definitely has a very large and devoted following. And it's something that people discover and either love it and have this thing for it, or they just don't get it.
I want my polka-dotted dickie with the crinoline fringe, or I'm going do-me-doing on a do-me-do binge.
Feinstein gets it. He loves the movie, with music by Frederick Hollander and lyrics by Dr. Seuss, so much that he spent the past 30 years gathering every scrap of music recorded for it. And he found so much material that it fills 3 CDs.
10 little dancing maidens dancing oh so fine. 10 happy little fingers and they're mine, all mine.
The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a technicolor fantasy, mostly an extended dream sequence of a boy who doesn't want to practice the piano. He imagines a cockeyed castle where his teacher, now the evil Dr. Terwilliger, has hypnotized his mother and taken 500 boys prisoner so they can play his music on a 5,000-key piano.
This is a movie that was a 1950s sort of homage or sequel, perhaps, to The Wizard of Oz, and that they wanted to create a very significant children's musical fantasy.
The original film score had 16 songs, 2 ballets, and was very dark. Maybe a little too dark.
First floor dungeon. Assorted simple tortures.
The movie was previewed. And there was one problem. It scared the heck out of all the little kids. And they ended up cutting half of the musical numbers.
Mary Healy and Peter Lind Hayes, who were married in real life, starred as the hypnotized mother and the plumber who saves her. Actress Kathy Lind Hayes is their daughter.
My dad had this film at home, and he would pull down the projection screen, and they always said, oh, we wish we could get a better version. So much has been cut.
Cut songs like this one are featured in the CD set.
I look to the sky, thanking the stars that you're here.
It seems that my 4th of July came in spring this year.
The CDs really showcase the music of Frederick Hollander, a German composer probably best known for writing The Blue Angel, starring Marlene Dietrich. Alan LaRoe is writing his biography.
Frederick Hollander is one of the most unappreciated Hollywood composers of the 30s and 40s, even though he was also very prolific.
While LaRoe likes the songs Hollander wrote for the film, he thinks the composer's best work is in the film's ballet sequence.
The great highlight of the score is the dungeon ballet, where musicians who do not play the piano have been consigned and they burst out of the background in moldy green tatters of their orchestral tuxedos and play a totally surrealist ballet that's a montage of different styles, playing delightful Seussian instruments.
I was a trombone.
George Chakiris, who became famous as Bernardo in the film of West Side Story, made his Hollywood debut at age 20 in the Dungeon Ballet.
For this particular sequence, they needed, I believe, it was 60 male dancers, and at that time it was the Screen Extras Guild, and there were not that many male dancers in the guild, so guys who were not members of the guild were allowed to audition. So I auditioned and I got the job, and I made enough money to actually join the guild as well, so it was a good thing.
The film might have been a good thing for Chakiris, but not so for Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss. It was a big flop. Alan LaRoe says Seuss referred to it as
the debaculous fiasco,
and he never wrote for the movies again. But Kathy Lind Hayes found herself at a screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T in Pasadena a few years ago.
I mean, it was like Rocky Horror Picture Show. They knew all the lines, and they were much, much younger than me. And I thought, well, isn't this interesting?
Come on, it's time we got together, 'cause it's get-together weather, and in get-together weather, together is just what we got to get.
And Michael Feinstein hopes the CD set will attract some new fans.
This is the first official release of the music, and even though some of it doesn't sound terrific, a lot of it does, and it will sound better than it has ever sounded before. So it's a wonderful feeling after literally three decades to see this thing in existence.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
As business resumes, I look forward to working together in that same spirit of common cause with members of Congress from both parties. Because before we are Democrats or Republicans, we are Americans.
That's President Obama speaking this morning from the White House, calling for unity in the wake of last weekend's tragedy in Tucson. It's Saturday, the day when James Fallows of The Atlantic often joins us to talk about the ideas behind the headlines. Jim, it's great to have you here.
Hello, Guy. Nice to talk to you.
Now, Jim, we just heard from President Obama a moment ago, picking up on his theme of civility. I know you and many of us watched that speech in Tucson this past week, a speech that may just be remembered as his most memorable.
I think so. And I am biased as a one-time speechwriter myself, but I've been thinking a lot about speeches this week. We're nearing the 50th anniversary of two very important speeches in American history, President Eisenhower's farewell address and about the military-industrial complex, and then John Kennedy's inaugural address right after that.
And Jim, we'll be talking more about Eisenhower's speech on the program tomorrow.
Good. And I think there's something interesting about his speech as a sort of threshold point, which is that it's one of the few speeches that's remembered mainly for the argument it presented. You know, we usually think of speeches as being logical presentations and they're designed to change people's minds. Mm-hmm. But actually, it seems to me, we usually remember them not so much for the point they're making, but the tone they create, how they make the audience feel about the speaker or the president, the public figure, about the nation's prospects, about their own position in life. And I think the ones we heard this week, President Obama's Tucson speech, the ideas in it were not so novel. We should be nicer to each other. It was the tone that made a difference.
Jim, I was struck by how many of President Obama's usual detractors praised that speech, and many of Sarah Palin's staunch supporters seemed a bit uncomfortable with hers.
It was quite a notable difference in tone. It certainly is the case that a negative and angry tone can sometimes work in political life, but in the long run, what people seem to want from their leaders is a source of hope. I think it was quite notable in how Barack Obama, who sometimes can have a sort of somber and downcast tone, instead he turned what could have been a very, very mournful occasion and something that obviously was based on terrible tragedy into a kind of rejoiceful and rejoicing ceremony of saying we can use this tragedy, this crime, as a way to renew ourselves and to come together. And so there was a very upbeat mood by the end. In contrast, we had Sarah Palin, who had a much more defensive tone about who should be blamed and who should not be blamed for these terrible events. And I thought that speaking entirely analytically, not supporting one side or the other here, I had the sense that I was watching a moment very much like the moment in which Edmund Muskie was crying on the New Hampshire campaign trail in 1972, or when Howard Dean had his scream moment. In the 2004 primaries, or when George Romney, the father of Mitt, when he was running for the Republican nomination in the 1960s, and he came back from Vietnam and said that he had been brainwashed there. And in all of those cases, fairly or unfairly, that moment sort of crystallized a change in that candidate's prospects. And My guess is, we won't know this for a while, but I think people will look back on that speech by Sarah Palin and its juxtaposition and contrast in tone with a speech later that evening by President Obama and saying that that was the time when her prospects changed. Whether or not she ever had a serious chance of winning the presidency, I think we have seen something like a Howard Dean moment in that speech.
That's James Fellows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can follow his blog at jamesfellows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you.
Thank you, Guy.
Last weekend's shootings in Arizona were followed by much debate and accusation. Many cited a tone of vitriol over the nation's airwaves and websites for helping to inflame the shooter to violence. Now, to be clear, it is not clear whether the man accused of the Tucson shootings heard or read any of the rhetoric that's been blamed. But this week may be a good opportunity to reflect on the quality of discussion and debate in this country today. We're joined by Eric Deggans, television and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. He joins us from his newspaper in Florida. Mr. Deggans, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Has heated rhetoric become a format?
Oh, yes. It's a format that earns millions of dollars for several people, particularly in cable news and particularly on talk radio. Contentious political debate is what fuels ratings and what earns big profits.
In the wake of the shootings in Tucson, were there some comments about the vitriol that were, in a sense, vitriolic in themselves?
Yeah, I'm thinking in particular Bill O'Reilly, who took on the New York Times saying that they were demonizing conservatives when and cited a line from a New York Times editorial that actually said that the contentious debate about the health care law, the new health care legislation, increased death threats against Democratic lawmakers, which was, true.
People have observed over the past few years, for example, that, this just didn't happen when 63 million people watch Walter Cronkite every night. But, I don't know, hasn't colorful and even intemperate speech been a part of politics and journalism?
Sure. I think, though, we have these media platforms that are increasingly bringing this debate into our lives in more intimate ways. Mm-hmm. We have blogs, we have websites, we have internet radio, we have satellite radio. You know, we have all these different platforms. And I think people have increasingly surrounded themselves, particularly people who are interested in this stuff, in a silo of media that reflects their opinions back to them. And we've reached a point where we can't agree on objective facts. We can't agree on things that typically we used to be able to agree on even when we were at our most contentious. You know, you can't necessarily say that this shooting was inspired by political rhetoric, but certainly it's a wake-up call that can make you take another look at what's happening and take some sort of corrective action.
You mentioned Bill O'Reilly. Keith Olbermann over on MSNBC, who kind of baits Bill O'Reilly often on his broadcast, he seemed to own up to maybe using some intemperate speech.
What's interesting to me about that is that this fits in with an argument that liberal commentators have been making for a while. So it is easier for Keith Olbermann to say, well, you know, maybe I crossed the line, because that doesn't turn off his audience. And in fact, that will appeal to his audience because he knows that there's a huge segment of his audience who believes that. So while I agree with him, and I'm glad that he's willing to put that out there on the table publicly, it's easier for him to do that because it fits his brand as a commentator.
I was interested in something you wrote this week in answer to people that say, look, this is just talk. It's just rhetoric. There's no proof that rhetoric leads to action.
Right. Well, what I noticed is that we have an entire free broadcasting media system built on the idea that media images promote specific action. That's the point of commercials on television. Mm-hmm. The idea that you present a product in an attractive way and it makes people want to buy it. And so if that is good enough to fuel an $8 billion TV commercial industry and pay, by the way, the salaries of Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck and Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and everybody else who works on free television, then certainly that notion might be something that we want to think about when it comes to the kind of really extreme rhetoric that we've seen out there.
For a number of reasons, maybe because it's simply entertaining, do we exaggerate the influence of cable news outlets? And I ask because just a fraction of the number of people that watch Brian Williams or Diane Sawyer every night, or for that matter, tuned to NPR, are actually watching the cable news services.
Yeah, that's true. I do think that we tend to overemphasize their impact because us commentators and media people and journalists, we have these cable channels playing in our newsrooms and in our offices all day. But I will also say that these channels tend to be watched by people who are more likely to vote. These channels tend to be watched by people who are more likely to have standing in their community. They set the tone for the debate that filters down into the community in other ways. So it's important to keep an eye on it.
So I don't have to tell you, Eric, nothing gets on the air these days without going through focus groups. I don't mean individual remarks so much as formats and approaches to programming and that sort of thing. So is the media just providing what the people want and the people don't realize they're getting affected by it, or are people constructing this for themselves?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that the audience has voted, and they prefer, particularly in prime time on cable news and in talk radio, they prefer these formats where there's this contentious debate. But again, you know, if you let people, I'm sure they would drive any speed they wanted to on the roads, you know. But we all decided sort of as a society that it's important to have speed limits. And I'm not suggesting a law like a speed limit. But what I'm saying is we all agree that even though we would like to have as much freedom as possible, sometimes it makes sense for us all to observe some limits for the common good.
Eric Deakins, television media critic at the St. Petersburg Times, and he writes a popular media blog called The Feed. Thanks so much.
This was really enjoyable. Thank you very much.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Jay Baker has one of the most famous last names in evangelical Christianity, or perhaps infamous, being the son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker.
The PTL Television Network presents Jim and Tammy!
At the height of their success, the Bakers' Christian television empire reached 13 million viewers, but it all came crashing down in 1987 after a sex scandal and then a fraud indictment that sent Jim Baker to prison. It was then when Jay Baker's life began to unravel. He got into drugs, became an alcoholic, and all but dropped out. But he never lost his connection to faith, and he's written about it in a new book called Falling to Grace. Back in 1994, Jay Baker co-founded Revolution Church, a place that was designed to be everything his parents' empire was not. For one thing, the church meets in a Brooklyn bar. And, well, then there's the preacher, Jay Baker.
Well, I'm about 5'8", covered in tattoos. I have full sleeves and my fingers tattooed. I wear a leather jacket and jeans usually and a T-shirt. So Marlon Brando is probably one of my fashion icons. Losing my hair, which is awesome.
I think you look a lot, I mean, strikingly similar to your father, Jim Baker. If Jim Baker was in a hardcore punk band, that's what you look like.
He was for a while.
He was before he went into the ministry.
I do. I look a lot like my father.
The tattoos isn't just about sort of describing your appearance, but it's actually a pretty fundamental part of who you are because of what those tattoos say. And I want to ask you about some of them. You have one on your body that says, "Religion destroys."
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Well, I've got it probably 10 years ago, and it's just the idea that man-made religion and tradition really hurt people, and we use it as a game. And my idea back then especially was as more of promoting a relationship with Jesus and following the life of Christ and not being religious about it. Religion can be a very dangerous thing, and I think it's a constant reminder to me to be careful.
The word grace shows up in this book a lot, and it's a word you use a lot. When you use that word, what do you mean?
It's, you know, unconditional acceptance, God's love for us, the free gift of, some people say, for the free gift of salvation, But to me, it's just God saying, I love you. I love you just the way you are, not the way you should be. I think grace is accepting that you're accepted. It's just that moment where you're able to say, I am accepted by a power greater than myself. And to me, that's grace. And grace gives us the ability to love others and love our enemies, which is sometimes a very tall order.
You are a pastor. You have a ministry. It meets in a bar in Williamsburg, which is like sort of the mecca, I guess, for hipster America, you know, where you got a lot of kids in skinny jeans riding fixed gear bikes.
a lot of adults.
you end your sermons asking your members to tip the bartender on their way out. Describe what a typical service is like, because you're in a bar.
Yeah, well, service is usually people get there early. Some people get drinks. Some people don't. I speak usually for 45 minutes to an hour sometimes. Then we dismiss, and then we hang out some more.
You have been very vocal about your support for things like gay marriage, that you believe abortion should be legal. I mean, couldn't somebody argue that you have actually just taken sort of liberal or left-wing ideas and applied them to your faith?
Oh, they argue it all the time. Mm. Yeah, definitely. You know, you're always going to have that. You know, I'm following my convictions, particularly with the LGBT issue. I just believe that everyone deserves equal and civil rights, and I believe that the Bible has been misconstrued to say things that aren't there, and I think it's hurt a lot of people, and I think it's the opposite of what I understand from the teachings of Christ and even the teachings of Paul, even though a lot of people will blame Paul for what some people call the clobber scriptures against the LGBTQ community. And I believe that the church is unfortunately still the tail light, as Martin Luther King used to say, and I'm hoping that we can become the headlight one day.
I know that you were very close with your mother and were with her up to the moment when she passed away. Talk a little bit about your relationship with your dad. What is it like?
Well, I mean, it's like the, you know, father and son thing. I mean, my dad was in prison for 5 years, so we didn't get to spend a whole lot of time together. So it's definitely like two men trying to express their love for each other, which is sometimes awkward for father and son. We definitely have different viewpoints on theology and different thoughts like that, and I'm trying to carry on my own thing. But, you know, I understand that if it wasn't for my father and the things that he did and my mother did, you know, I wouldn't be here today, and I wouldn't be doing what I am doing. So I like to give credit where credit's due, but at the same time, you know, me and my dad aren't going to always see eye to eye. He loves me, and I'm his son. He always says that. I'm like, you know, Dad, I'm probably going to get you in some trouble. People are probably going to say, you know, why don't you control your son? And he goes, well, son, I love you. So it's gotten to the point where we're not trying to change each other. I think we're just trying to understand each other.
Mm-hmm. You've been accused of sort of engaging in what some people call cafeteria Christianity, where you kind of pick and choose what you want. On your Facebook page, and I haven't seen it recently, but it did say that under religion it did say changing.
Yeah.
And you have questioned or wondered whether things like hell exist, whether the Bible really does condemn homosexuality, whether sodomites were nothing more than simply people from the town of Sodom.
Right.
Can you sort of explain how you sort of get to that point with some of those issues?
Well, studying the Bible, Greek and Hebrew, and studying the historical background to the cities and the letters that were written, you know, I was always told if I read the Bible, things would become more black and white, and that's just not what happened. The more I studied the Bible, things became more gray. The Bible isn't a book that you can just pick up and just read as a sixth grade level. I mean, it's a good book, and I want people to read it. But as soon as you start to look deeper into the book itself, into the context, into when it was written, things start to change, and you start to see things in a different way and realize that maybe we've been taking a really elementary understanding of Christianity.
Do you pray every day?
No. I try to pray every day, but there's sometimes where my doubt gets the best of me.
Hmm. I'm sure a lot of people would be surprised to hear that, but you are an abiding Christian. I mean, you were a faithful Christian.
Yeah, most of the time, you know. I mean, like I said, doubt is a big part of my faith, and without doubt, I feel like there's no growth. So, you know, it's a constant struggle, but to me, it's a beautiful struggle.
That's Jay Baker. He's the pastor of Revolution Church in New York and the author of the new book Fall to Grace: A Revolution of God, Self, and Society. Jay, thank you so much.
Thank you.